Hi mamas, welcome back to Mama Social the Pod. Today's episode is one that's slightly different for us. You guys know we speak raw, real, unfiltered conversations. So when the opportunity came to speak to a mother who is in the trenches, who is experiencing something that none of us want to think about, I think it was only fair to give her a platform to speak her truth. Miss Chloe Green is an incredible human, and me and Lauren left this conversation feeling blessed and honoured to be able to have spoke to her and to speak her family's truth. So thank you, Chloe, for gracing us with your presence, and we hope you enjoy it and take away what we took from the experience. Remember to like, follow, subscribe, and continue sending in them icks, parent fails, dating dilemmas, because they don't go unnoticed. They're incredible, the community that we're building here. So thank you so much for that. And please listen in to this really frank conversation.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Mama Social, the podcast. I'm Lauren.
And I am Kaylee. Today, we are here with a beautiful guest, Chloe Green, who's going to talk about motherhood, parenthood, and a situation that we don't ever want to find ourselves in, but just to have a conversation that, yeah, I don't know how else to say this. So, Chloe, it's over to you. Let's have a little whistle stop tour on who you are, how many kids you've got. Go for it.
Perfect. So, yeah, I mean, I became a mother 5 years ago now. I've got two children. So I've got my little boy, Theo, who is 5. He'll be 6 in March. And I've got my daughter, Evie, who turned 4 in June. And both beautiful, funny children, but our situation is a little bit different to like a standard family life, because the situation that we're in is we are currently living in hospital waiting for my daughter Evie to receive a heart transplant. So we're in Newcastle currently. We've been there for nearly 10 months now. So coming up to 10-month mark that we've been waiting for a new heart. And one thing I'm trying to do a lot is just to talk about organ donation and childhood organ donation during this journey, because again, it's sort of something that people don't ever want to talk about, especially when it comes to children. But that's the situation that we are in, finding ourselves trying to just break the taboo a little bit about organ donation and what people would do if they were in our situation, because we are obviously in a situation where we need an organ, but it's a completely different matter when people are suddenly contemplating whether to donate or not their child's organs. And I totally understand why people feel uncomfortable about it, but hopefully if they learn a bit more about Evie and the things that we're going through, that they can suddenly think, actually, look at what can be so amazing from such a horrible decision.
Yeah.
So can we go back to the very start of how you found out that Evie needed a heart transplant? Because that's a big thing, obviously.
Yeah.
So could you share something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Evie was actually, at the beginning of this year, we knew what her condition was when it comes to her heart. We always knew that this was on the agenda. So in October 2019.
You were pregnant?
Not so much when I was pregnant, when she was 4 months old, she was diagnosed. So she was actually absolutely completely fine pregnancy. She was born at 40 weeks. She was 8 pounds 1. There was nothing picked up on scans that there was anything wrong with her heart. It was when we hit around the 3-month mark. She was a very unsettled baby, and we thought it was like the common things like reflux or, you know, colic. As you all hear, you drive yourself demented, don't you, as a parent, thinking, well, what's wrong with them? Why are they so unsettled? And a lot of the time it is just something minor. But for us, it was just a constant battle of thinking, what's going on? This is just a bit confusing, and she's just always crying. And then when she was 4 months old, she had bronchiolitis, and we found ourselves in and out of A&E, but discharged, because they said the same, it's a viral infection, it'll all go away with time and things like that. And then it was only when they did a chest x-ray, because this bronchiolitis just wasn't shifting and she was coughing all the time, that it showed she had a really enlarged heart. And that condition is called dilated cardiomyopathy. So it's where the left ventricle that pumps blood around the body is so severely enlarged that it's not functioning properly and not delivering the blood to the body as it should be, so leaving her in heart failure. And when she was diagnosed, she got onto medication and done well, and had a couple of admissions when she was a baby, but managed to respond well with like the hospital and the amazing doctors. It was more a case of her heart function stayed the same for about 3 years, and then about this time last year she just started getting worse in herself. And yeah, in January this year, that's when they turned around and said, look, things are not looking good. She's deteriorating. She's not gaining weight. She's not thriving. We think that we're going to have to admit her to try and boost her heart function and hopefully list her for a transplant and let her wait at home. But then that led into the situation that actually we're waiting in hospital, and she's actually attached to a mechanical heart called the Berlin heart. And she cannot go home on that. So she's going to be waiting that whole time until she gets a new donor.
This is mind blowing.
I know.
Mind blowing, yeah.
In a couple of minutes, but
how do you even navigate that? Like, so she's attached. So is the
heart keeping her alive?
Yeah.
The one that she's attached to, yeah. Did you say it was a Berlin heart?
Berlin heart, yes.
Berlin heart.
This machine, it looks a bit like a suitcase, that's how I can describe it. And she's got two pipes surgically attached to her heart, which does the function of the left ventricle. So it'll pump the blood around the body for her, because her heart's just too sick to do that now without any sort of mechanical support. And that keeps her alive.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. But also terrifying.
Yeah.
Did you say she was two, Chloe?
She's four.
So how...
She's four.
So like, how do you stop a four-year-old? How do you even explain to a four-year-old what's happening?
Well, we were actually really lucky that when she first got admitted, she seen another little girl who was about 2 years old, who was on the Berlin heart. And she had, like, the best thing about this machine is you can have quite a good quality of life. You're just running around after her. It's just like you're pushing a suitcase with her. That's the only way I can describe it. And she
seen
this little girl had this quality of life and could still play and still do things, so that, I mean, she did deteriorate to the point where she needed the machines, but she was obviously quite poorly that she didn't really know what was going on. And then when she was first placed on the machine, she was ventilated and had to recover in herself. But it was not as hard as I think it would have been if she hadn't seen it, because then all of a sudden, a four-year-old looking at her chest thinking, why have I got two pipes? And, you know, they're quite painful for her. So she does have to have things like Aura Morph, you have to have dressing changes 3 times a week because of the risk of infection. There's quite a few risks with this machine, as amazing as it is. And I think that's a lot to take for a four-year-old, definitely. Really. And she's a very anxious girl.
It's a lot to take for you as well, though, like all of you as a family, like.
Yes.
It's it's a lot.
Yeah. And I think as well. Sorry, Kaylee.
Sorry.
I was just going to say that. How does my partner cope?
I feel like there's a little delay in this.
It was a tiny little one, but I'll let you ask. Were you going to say about my partner?
Yeah, like how does your partner and your son mm-hmm.
yes.
deal with all of this? Because this is like a 24/7 job for you.
Yeah.
So how is that?
It's tough. My little boy he's a very sensitive little boy as well, and he's had a hard time adjusting to having his family living in hospital. The way we work actually is me and my husband will rotate every 3 days. So one of us is with Evie for 3 days and then one of us goes back home, because we're from Middlesbrough, so we're not too far away, to then be Theo, because he goes to school, he's in year one. I can't pull him out of school or anything like that. So we've kind of go on and have our own little routine as such, which, I mean, it's working. I'd say it's working, but we're only doing it as a temporary measure. We're doing it temporary, but such a long-term measure. We're kind of just trying to wing it, to be honest.
How long have you been doing this for?
Since
Living in hospital?
So February this year.
God.
Mm-hmm. February 15th.
Yeah. What about work? Do you work?
Yeah, I work I don't work currently. I'm currently off on the sick, as is my partner. We've both been off on the sick because our minds are just not in the frame of work. I work for Sunderland.
Well, I can well imagine. So, yeah. But so, then, how long does the sickness last? Like, how long do you get paid? Do you get paid enough? Surely there should be something.
Like a statutory sick. Well, if there is.
Well, statutory. Yeah, but statutory sick is shite.
Yeah.
Like, surely there should be something.
There should be definitely more support.
Parents like this. Like, do you know what? Yeah.
It's not a normal
what
situation.
Did you do before this?
No.
What did I. Sorry, say that again, Kayleigh. I didn't catch that.
What did you do before this? Like, what was your job?
So I worked for Sunderland Council, part-time, thankfully, and I worked in schools, just going in and educating about healthy lifestyles, which in itself is quite scary because I can't go back into that role because I can't mix with children because she's already really vulnerable. If I go into schools and catch things like that's going on, like RSV, that's a big one that makes kids so vulnerable and poorly if they catch it. I couldn't go back in a capacity where I'm in schools. I do think I'll be returning soon as a work from home basis only, but I don't really want to. I'm only doing it because I have to for the money. I stopped getting my pay in January. So then after that, it's like a case of I'm going to have to because, like you say, money doesn't last and it is like a financial burden. And I do agree that this should be something in place for families like us because it's not a normal situation. It's not like she's just got a mortgage done in a week. We're like waiting for something that could take years, really.
How long could she stay on the Berlin Heart?
It's a funny one because although the Berlin Heart's a great machine, there's quite a few risks to it. One of them being an infection and one of them being a stroke. Because if you think that when you attach plastic into your body automatically tries to get rid of it and it'll clot. So she's on quite a large amount of blood thinners to keep her blood nice and thin to prevent clotting, as well as stuff to stop like a blood cell sticking together because the chance of a stroke on that machine is 30%, which... I mean, it's quite high. It's high, but then some people think it's not that high. I don't know. And Evie's had issues.
30% is high for a stroke.
Yeah.
That's mental in a four-year-old.
And in September, Evie had sepsis really, really severely and nearly passed away as a result of it because of a bug that was growing on her Berlin Heart pipes and it managed to get into her blood. So you think that's where there's all these risks that come with it. And sometimes you think, oh, infections, you can treat them with antibiotics and it'll be fine. But Evie's actually now on 4 lots of antibiotics till transplant because of how many infections she's had. So she's been quite problematic, even on their sort of standards. But thankfully, in terms of like clotting, she's never had a stroke, but the risk is always there and you just don't know. It could just happen anytime. And that's the scariest part of that machine. As amazing as it is, you just don't know what the future holds in that sort of sense. So coming back to when you're saying how long can she last, it's whether the complications can sort of stay away. There was a little girl a few years ago who was on it for 2 and a bit years. And that's the longest, I believe, in the UK. Whether there's been longer cases in like America and stuff, I'm not sure. But in the UK, I think it's something like 27 months. And she did suffer with a stroke as well.
It just must be so awful to be in this situation. So how do you find the joy? What does Evie love to do? What do you love to do together? To find that simplicity in parenthood.
Yeah. Do you know what? Evie is the most creative, craftiest little girl ever. She's happy as long as she's playing. And I'm so grateful that she's like that and she's constantly on the go, because it's only really like on a night time I'll stop and think, I'm like, oh, when's, like, you think about these things, like, when's she going to get a donor? Is it ever going to happen? But through the day, I don't really have the time to dwell on it compared to when she was diagnosed as a baby. Because when they're a baby and they're asleep, that's when you do start thinking and time feels like it's dragging. Whereas as a four-year-old, you just don't stop. She literally does not stop at all. And I find myself being like, Evie, you just have too much energy. And I love it. I love that she has that much energy, because that shows feeling good. And I take the pleasure out of her being happy. It's when she's not happy. And I've seen her many times in this journey not happy, but to know, like, I just can't take it for granted at all. Those smiles and anything like that are just worth it, worth all of the rubbish in this whole journey.
I wish you were here so we could give you a massive cuddle.
I know.
Because you're an absolute warrior, like a hero. This is what us mums are built for, is when shit is thrown at us, how do we get through it with that positive mindset, with that positive spin? And, you know, it just feels like it's an awful situation. So how do we... I know you want to come on and make people aware of the situation, or how can we help you, Evie, the whole transplant journey? Like, how do we get involved?
I think for us, because obviously the main thing that will help her, we don't really have a lot of control over it. So it's just making people talk about it. And I try and say, don't imagine your child dying. Try and imagine Evie's journey and what a heart could do for her. Think of it like that, because if you find yourself in that horrible situation, you could then maybe think, put sort of a face to a child and think, actually, if I donate that, that would be like a legacy of that life to live on in another child and provide that gift of life, as you say. And I think it's very easy as well, like, for me to sort of say, you know, organ donation and everything like that. But it's those that choose to give are the true warriors. And it's sometimes quite also, I don't know, challenging to think about. And if you are in that situation and you've had no preparation, I imagine some people are just like, no, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about that. I just want you to leave my baby alone. And I totally get that. But sometimes I think just a little bit of challenging your brain to just think about sort of that situation by using our journey as an example can take a little bit of the seriousness out of it, because it could save, like, it could save lives at the end of the day. Just talk. And that's all I invite people to do, is just talk about journeys, talk about what you do. And one of the organ donation, like, little taglines is sort of thinking about, would you accept a donated heart to save your child? And if you would you then give that same gift of life on? Because I think the majority of people out there as a parent would accept a donated heart or donated organ to save the child. I don't know how many people that would say, like, no.
Yeah. No, exactly. You wouldn't, would you? I do think it's because the way that I am, I try not to think about negative things. So to have that conversation about organ donation, I wouldn't want to put out into the universe. Do you know what I mean? Like, because then you've got to think about a child dying to save another child, and that is a really hard thought.
Yeah.
But then I feel like if it, God, touching a lot of wood, if it came to it, it is a hard conversation to have, because you don't want to have that conversation with the thought of your child.
Yeah.
But it is a conversation that's needed, like you said. Like,
And I think that's where, like,
it's our journey
as well. You just, rather than thinking about your child, think about other journeys, because then if, God forbid, anyone was in this situation, and if you think about actually the logistics of it and who it could save, and not so much what's going on, even though you would be, I totally understand, in that situation, you would be thinking of the worst and you would be absolutely heartbroken. But there's a little part of your brain that's probably already confronted it and thinking, actually, I remember seeing that little girl from Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
Her heart, and she, like, you know, she's such a little sweetie. They could live on in her, you know. You think that she would keep that memory alive.
Yeah.
It's trying, and I'm exactly
like, organ donation is fucking brilliant, like absolutely brilliant. Like a transplant has saved my brother-in-law's life. He is alive right now because of a transplant, so a donor. And that is, it's all so mind-blowing, and it's incredible what they can do. So yeah. I am all for it, all for it. But yeah, like, you know, obviously as an adult, you can apply for your driving license and tick a box of whether or not you want to donate your organs.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work with a child? A child have to pass away for then the parent to give
consent
to use?
Everybody, you have to opt out. So anybody who dies now, you, like, we can be harvested.
It's
so interesting you say that, because there is an opt-out scheme, but if you, so say one of you's passed away and your partner was there, they said, touch wood, they decided, no, I don't want to. They would get the overall say, regardless of what you've consented to. They still have the overall say. Yeah. Doesn't matter about the whole opt-out thing. That's you obviously indicating, but it will always go as like a final sort of decision. And it's the same with children. The opt-out scheme doesn't apply. And again, in that situation, it would be a conversation with the coordinators and the family about what they want to do. Regardless of whether a child has, because a child can sign up for it. Normally when you sign, you know, when you change GPs, you can fill the form in on there. I'm pretty sure you can tick it on there. And the website will allow you to sign your child up. So you do have those sort of things in place. But it's, again, a conversation really that would only really matter when someone's passed away, which is awful. I mean, I'd be absolutely furious if my husband turned around. I mean, I would be furious, but I'd be not here, so I wouldn't be able to be angry, but
I'd come back and haunt him.
I remember hearing someone having a conversation and the husband like, I wouldn't sign away your organs, no way, like anything like that, and they were really angry. And that's exactly how I would be. I'd be like, you're literally going against my wishes. I want to donate my organs,
yeah,
because you're my next of kin and you're not comfortable with it, you're saying no. It's not really right, to be honest, especially if you've expressed that you do want to give organs. But
it's about having that open conversation with your partner and being like, so, because me and Dale's already spoke about what we wanted, what I want to be buried, who wants to be cremated. And like, when I say that to my friends, they're like, what are you talking about, stuff like that for? And I'm like, yeah, you don't want to think about dying, but I also don't want to be put in an oven and burnt, because he thinks that what he would want is what I would want.
Yeah.
So we've spoke about organ donation, and for some reason, I know I'll probably get a lot of hate here, they can take anything but my eyes.
Why not your eyes? Loads of people think that, don't they?
When I go to heaven, I'll just be walking around blind. And I know it's stupid, because I'm just a ball of energy that's dotting around doing a thing. Like, it's really common. The eyes. Why is that?
Going to the eye thing, because I've done research on this, because I was a bit like, you have that sort of, ooh, someone touching my eyes. But it's actually like the outer layer of your eye. It's not like your eyeballs or your pupils. It's just like the little, you know, the gooey bit.
But don't take my whole eye.
No. There you go. You won't be walking around having no eyeballs. You'll be fine. Sign away the eyes.
I'm not talking that much detail, but it's like that is what it is, because then actually people might be a bit more open to it if they thought, actually, they're not taking the whole thing. They're just taking the little, I can't remember what it's called, like corneas or something. It's just like the outer layer of the eyeball.
Yeah.
So I don't think they would take
them.
They
don't remove my eye.
No.
The bowl.
I imagine they would just take what they need and put them back.
Oh, I hope so. Right, well, they can take my eyes, then I'll tell Dale tonight that I'm full harvested. Take the lot. Because really, what you said about... have the conversation, and God forbid it ever happens, it's a strange conversation, because as soon as your somebody dies... For them people to then, whoever needs to come from the hospital and be like, by the way, do you know that you could do this when they're in the height of grief?
Yeah.
That must be a really strange job or a strange, how do they even navigate when to ask for the best time? Because like you say, some people might be like so distraught with grief that it's like an absolute no-go away. But if you come, you know, a small period of time later, it might be a different conversation.
I think that's the thing. I don't envy their job. That must be the worst job in the world, to approach a grieving family to discuss that. And they must have to read carefully as well, especially for things like religion as well, because you do, like, some religions are against organ donation as well, so you have that kind of side of things. But
it's just like, so run us through your day. Like, on a day when it's one of your 3 days, and, yeah, how does it work? Because in my head, because I've got a friend that did have to live in, was it the Freeman?
Yeah.
It might have been the Freeman. And it's a little, like, a block by itself, I think. It's not like in the hospital. So what's your day-to-day setup like?
Yeah. I'll go for like, so tomorrow's a busier day. So I'll go from tomorrow like as a classic day of Evie. So normally I would go over to the ward about 8:15 when they finished handover the nurses, because you're not allowed to be in the room when they're handing over for patient confidentiality. And Evie's either...
Just a quick one then. So Evie sleeps in the hospital on a ward, and you're in an apartment type of thing.
Yes, sorry, yes. So Evie stays on the ward, ward 23, in Freeman. Like, that's the place where the children's heart unit is, up north. And she stays in HDU, and HDU, high dependency, you don't have a bed to sleep next to her. So you get given a key to the Sick Children's Trust home, which is Scott House. Which is where, like, me or my husband stay and, you know, get our night's sleep, and then we come over. And you can cook and things like that there. It's quite a nice, it's almost like having a little hotel room as you such, but with, like, communal, like, bathrooms and a communal kitchen, and, like, if you've got kids and you need to bath them and stuff. It's really good, really good. And you stay there free of charge, which is amazing as well. Fantastic charity. So, yeah, I would leave there about... just after 8 and get to the ward, and she's either still asleep or just about to wake up, depending. She can be a bit of a night owl, so she stays up a bit late, especially when I'm on. And then we normally would start the day by doing her dressings. So her dressings would be her pipes, and they have to be done every 2 days because, again, of the risk of infection and just keeping them clean and intact. And that takes about 20 minutes. And that's quite distressing for Evie because it's uncomfortable for her, pain. So she'd be given things like Oromorph, morphine to just help with the pain. And she'll have that done. She'll also have Hickman line dressing done, which is she's got a Hickman line to receive medications. It just saves her on cannulas and things like that. It gives her everything that she needs, or they can do bloods out of it. So it's a really handy thing to have. And then once those jobs are done on a Tuesday, it's actually quite a nice day because the play specialists there are amazing, and they have things like they have a little music class on the afternoon. They also Evie also has the teacher, so she's doing school there, which is really good. So on a Tuesday she has art, and then she has like a regular school class, which for a 4-year-old is really good because it's keeping her engaged and everything like that. Yeah. She'll have like observations done every 4 hours, but also coming back to her Berlin heart, they have to check her pipes every 2 hours for any signs of clots. So if they see anything that could be dangerous, it could be potentially a trip to theatre to have it removed, which again is another procedure, but it's not that common. It hasn't happened to Evie for a good 3-4 months now, so we're doing okay in that respect. But touch wood, not taking any chances with that. But it's just a case of going to theatre for like a couple of minutes and just suctioning the clot out, but it has to be sterile and clean, of course. And then, yeah, to be honest, the day kind of ticks by with that them sort of like little things. Obviously, she has to have ops, but we do spend a lot of the time in the playroom, which is great because, again, she keeps me busy that I'm either drawing or painting or doing fun and games. Tomorrow they've actually got the hospital Christmas tree switch on. So she's got that to look forward to. And, you know, that it kind of all just merges the day. And then you have your bedtime sort of routine about 7 o'clock. She has to have melatonin to help her sleep. So that's a medication that'll just basically help her just go to sleep, because again, she's a night owl. She'd probably stay up till midnight if she could. And yeah, like it doesn't sound bad when it's a day like that because they're really busy, but it's when things aren't going so well, that's when it can be really challenging. Like if she's having to be observed a bit more or she's not feeling very well, and that's when you're watching her like a hawk and thinking, what's going on? Why is things happening? What's this? And constantly questioning the nurses. But on a day like today, like I've just left her with the teacher and I'm just like talking to yous, and it's just a nice day. And I know that she's in such a good mood and in good spirits that it's not stable. And that's what keeps me going when things are sort of ticking along like this, because this has now become our routine in a really non-normal way, but it feels normal because this has been like 10 months. So honestly, it's so bizarre. And I talk about it like it's normal life, but I'm well aware it's not. It really isn't.
But I suppose it is your normal now. Like that is going to be your normal.
Mm-hmm.
And is there ever a time when you are all together in the hospital, like you, your partner, your little boy?
Yes, on a weekend.
So you get to spend family time.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing, Theo doesn't stay at Scott House because he's not great at sleeping out. But when we're on a weekend, we'll spend all day together and they'll play and they'll have like a McDonald's or things like that. So they do still have that family time, and you know, they're like best friends, really. They get on so well. So it has been quite challenging. More challenging for Theo, I'd actually say, because with Evie, I feel like she gained a family at the hospital because the nurse, she loves the nurses and the doctors and the other patients, whereas Theo is actually at home with just one parent most of the time, and he's got no one else. And that is really hard for him. And he's been very clingy in that sort of respect. And it's understandable. Yeah. And it's one of those things. It's like, I don't know what to do. I can only do the best I can. And I do try my best, but sometimes you just have to just get on with things and just hope that things will eventually get there.
I think with communication with Theo as well, and understanding what he needs to understand, not the gory details type of thing, but having them frank conversations of why mummy and daddy have to spend so much time up at the hospital. So run us through your day with Theo then. So on the other 3 days where you're not at hospital, what does that look like, and what's the juxtaposition of the different life is?
To be honest, Theo's pretty similar to Evie. He just wants to play games and play things all the time. But it's on a day, like, so today he's at school. That's when I'll choose to just do the normal stuff, get the housework done, maybe go and meet a friend for a cup of tea. I do try and have those moments of myself because I'll go crazy if I don't. and, you know, yeah. I'll take him to places within reason. So I've been avoiding things like kids' parties, which it's just be for Evie's safety and yeah. so that way I'm not taking anything into her. But we do, I'll take him like bowling, I'll take him to places. Like, I'll do my best to just keep him entertained, and so does my husband, and spend a lot of time with our families because they are totally supportive of the situation. And he's got plenty of cousins that he can play with and keep him entertained.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just a general sort of life with Theo. It's just a bit more quieter because obviously I've got half of the family not there, which is, it's, yeah, very weird. Very weird. Whereas the hospital is so fast-paced and people everywhere at all times, it doesn't feel as quiet until you really get home yeah. and you realise, whoa, it's really lonely now.
Do you get much time as a couple or any time as a couple?
We try every, I mean, it just depends on things like childcare and stuff like that. But maybe once yeah. a month we will try and spend a night both at Scott House because there is two beds here. So, yeah. single bed, so you can't be in a double. But you do try and spend that couple time together, going out for food and just, yeah. But it's not the same as being at home. Like, it'll yeah. never, ever be the same. But Evie loves that because then she's got both her mummy and daddy there with her and it's more fun for her. But that's the thing. It would be lovely if one day, like, Theo could feel comfortable being at Scott House as well, sleeping there. But I think he's such an anxious boy. He doesn't like staying out a lot.
Yeah.
It's just more a case of he's too clingy and wants to be in his own bed. Not a clingy in a bad way, just doesn't, he's scared. He's just scared of what's going to happen. And there's been a lot of unpredictable things happen where suddenly he's had to go to, like, his grandma and granddad's at the middle of the night, them sort of things.
Yeah.
And that must be really unnerving for him. We're just responding off the adrenaline of the situation and the seriousness of things. But for him, it's like, oh, what's going on? My parents are suddenly at grandma's. I went to sleep in my own bed. And yeah, really, really tough. But as a couple, we try to get some time. Like when we swap over, me and Dave, we will try and spend a couple of hours just having some lunch and stuff. But we tend to be rushing around because we don't like to leave Evie for long periods of time. We always like to get back to her because she just wants to be entertained. So no one's entertaining her. She's kicking off. She's like, someone play with me. But obviously she can't have the nurses playing with her all day because they're busy doing jobs. They are great though. The nurses will try and play with her when they can. But yeah, we try and get back to her as soon as we can. So it's a little bit more condensed. I'd say it's like having a long distance relationship a little bit. Very strange.
Yeah.
It sounds like you've got a really strong relationship, though.
Yeah. We've been together for 10 years now, and I think if we can get through this so far, we'll probably be able to get through anything because, my God, it's been challenging. It's not challenging so much for the relationship. It's just the stress and the strain of everything just piled into one.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit of I cry a lot when things are going wrong or things are not good. And he tries to sort of be like a bit more positive. And sometimes I'm like, but I just want to cry. I need to cry and let this all out. It's just horrible.
Yeah, like just let me be negative for a minute.
Yeah, let me cry and then I'll be over it.
Yeah, you just need that time.
I was listening to somebody. Yeah,
definitely.
I was listening to somebody because I'm obsessed on like podcasts, and the one I was listening to today was saying that they feel like, especially in women, because we cry a lot when we're so overwhelmed with emotion, that our default, our whole system just goes, and now cry, and then it resets the emotional balance, and then you're like, right, okay, I can have a conversation. I can work out how we're going to navigate this thing, but I've got to cry to get it all out. And Dale doesn't, my partner doesn't understand that at all. He's like, that's a waste of energy, sobbing. Like, you know, you've chopped your leg off. Like, he doesn't get why I need to have a cry, but I totally need to go have a cry, let it all out, and then come back.
Yeah, definitely. Therapeutic, I think. Definitely. And, you know, some of the situations I'm crying in, I'm like, I've got very good reason to cry. Just let me cry.
I mean, yeah.
I don't need to be positive right now. It's a quite a grim situation. Just let me be negative. And then you're just responding off the situation, and then things improve and you can start to breathe a little bit. And I'm just totally responsive off things like that. But I see what you mean about the whole emotional thing, because I'm like that if I get angry and then I get into tears and I'm like, but I'm not upset. I want to be angry.
I'm looking at Lauren over here.
So let's think of the future then. And it's, you've said this, but it's crap to think that, because I didn't, it's silly to not know, but like I thought anybody could donate any organ to any child, but obviously I can't give a lung to a child because it wouldn't fit in. So like to think of what has to happen to get Evie better is an awful thing.
Yeah.
But what is the future for you guys as a family? What is the thing that's making you keep going on strong?
I guess it's just imagining life like last year, really, just back being a four. We're not like a really flashy couple, like going on holidays all the time and stuff like that. We just like to sit and chill a lot of the time and, you know, have the arguments, the tantrums, and have the cozy Christmases and lovely birthdays. I think with Evie's diagnosis, we were never really a mingly sort of always out, always at parties and stuff. We were more into going for walks and a bit more into nature. So it was nice to just appreciate that and have that family time. Because now it's like it's split in half and it's like we just need that donor heart to just bring us back together. Because understandably, the future, if thankfully it goes the right way, touch wood, it'll be back at home and we'll still be managing a condition. So we kind of know what that looks like, where you're really cautious about going out, worried about mixing with people who've got like COVID or colds or anything like that. I kind of know what life is like to deal with something like that, because essentially you're just swapping one condition for another one, because getting a transplant, you're then immunosuppressed for life. So your immune system is compromised and you need to keep that sort of managed as such. So like you say, it's nothing too fancy. It's just a case of getting back to normal and being a little bit selfish as well, like going back to work and like being able to see people a bit more and talk about normal things. Because sometimes I talk and I'm like, oh my god, I sound tragic all the time, because I'll talk really matter of fact. I talk really matter of fact, and then I'm like, this is so not normal what I'm talking about. And some people's faces are like, what? What are you talking about? And I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably a bit grim. Probably shouldn't talk about sepsis and stuff like that, because it's not normal. And being home and not dealing with hospital life will make things a lot more normal. And just, yeah, that's all I'm looking forward to and envisioning, is just being back home as a family of four. Like just anything normal. And maybe a holiday.
Do we know how many kids are waiting for heart transplants?
So I know, I think from the last statistics, there's 46 children waiting for a heart. That's not 46 waiting in hospital. Yeah. No, that's the ones that are listed. So I think around that number, there might be about 15 to 20 waiting in hospital. In terms of kids that wait for organs in general, it's something like 250 children. That's always sort of the mark. It's been 250 kids waiting for like kidneys, intestinal sort of transplants, multi-organs. Some people need heart and lungs. It's just, it's so scary. And you know, you live in your own little bubble and think this is so awful, but there's 200 odd kids out there who have such a poor quality of life as well, dealing with waiting for a new organ, whether that be a kidney or a lung or a heart. It's just, it's not fair. That's when you realise life isn't fair, because, you know, all of this happening to kids is just, it's not, it changes you as a person.
Yeah, it's not fair.
No. And yeah, it's tough. But as if we can, that's why we talk about these things, organ donation, and that's why I encourage people to keep talking, because it could save one of those, not even 250 kids, it could save like 7,000 odd people who are waiting for an organ, because then you think of all the adults waiting as well. Like, it's just, it's sad, but what an amazing thing to think that someone has saved your life as well, like going generally speaking. And, you know, you see some sort of posts occasionally where you can be a living donor as well. And honestly, if I was in the position where I could give something, I would definitely give like a kidney to like my husband or something like that. If it would just be like,
yeah,
such an amazing feeling to know that that's provided life, really. You've given that life to someone else. And I think as well, like going to the dark side and thinking, although a child might have passed away or a person's passed away, they're living on in someone else.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on and sharing your story. It's, like I said at the beginning, nobody wants to talk about it. It's very taboo. It's uncomfortable. But giving you the platform to talk about Evie and talk about, I don't know, you need a Just Giving page. You need something that's going to help you and your husband sustain being there with her. So if we can facilitate with anything, just hit us up.
Because thank you. I do have Evie's page, which I talk about her journey on. So even just sharing that to like the followers would be amazing. Just so people know.
Yeah, let's share the page. Mm-hmm. Let's share some charities and stuff as well. Like you mentioned the charity that the house that you live in.
Yes.
Is from, so like that. And who funds the, like, you know, the schooling in the hospital and the music lesson? Like, who funds that?
So that's, they're called CHUF, the Children's Heart Unit Fund.
Oh, yes. I've heard of CHUF.
Kind of well known, yeah. Really, really amazing. Them, Red Sky Foundation, if you've ever heard of them, I think they're quite big in Sunderland.
Yeah.
The one with the girl, isn't it?
Yeah.
Height.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, it's the Sick Children's Trust, so they have loads of homes. They're quite similar to Ronald McDonald's charity houses, I think, because you'll hear a lot of them from, well, McDonald's. But this is, like, a different version, but the same sort of facilitators. But to be honest, like, there's so many, but they're the three main ones that have been so supportive for us as a family. Just And CHUF, I've always had a special place in my heart ever since she was diagnosed because of what they do and just how they make you feel as a more like a family. It's that family feel. And knowing that I'll always have that. I know for a fact that I'll always be fundraising for them regardless. I mean, I'm not doing anything right now, but in a couple of years when I've like the situation is sorted, I'll be able to do a bit more fundraising activities for them because they are amazing, really good.
Well, hit us up because we'll get involved with anything.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
You're welcome. So go and have a lovely rest of your day. And
we send Evie our love as well.
I will definitely. Probably torturing everyone right now, being like, where's mummy? Why is she not playing with me?
Mummy's having a chat.
Oh, she hates me having a conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Katie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
See you later.
See you soon.